Follow me down this deep, dark hole.
Hello and welcome to New Horror Express, your fortnightly podcast chatting to the best indie talent the horror genre has to offer. I'm your host Scott Murphy, and on today's episode, I'm chatting to Rob Grant, who's only the second returning guest we've had in the show's short history after Brent Simmons. Last time, we talked about his movie Alive, and our conversation was sadly cut short as Rob had to catch a plane. This time, however, we more than make up for that as we chat for a little over an hour about his latest film, the dark comedy horror Harpoon. Be warned though, there are some mild spoilers in the interview as we go into depth on the themes and characters of the film. Also, talking about the film gave us a launching pad to go in some pretty unexpected conversational tangents, more of which you will find out very soon. But before then, I would like to quickly remind you the best way you can support New Horror Express is to rate, review, and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, on Stitcher, and the Radio Public. Anyway, now on to the interview with Rob. Hi Rob, welcome back to New Horror Express. It's good to have you back on the show. Only our second returning guest.
Oh, I feel so privileged. That's awesome. Thank you very much for having me again. Last time, felt like we talked about a ton of stuff, but it got cut off a little short because I was at the airport. And good to get right back into where we left off.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So I think the starting point, since the Fright Fest announcements were made just a couple of days ago, not when this episode goes out, but, you know, like when we're recording this, it went out just a couple of days ago. You've been announced for Fright Fest, and it was also recently announced that Arrow are going to be distributing your new movie, Harpoon.
Yes.
A couple of exciting announcements for you there.
Yeah, I mean, like, Arrow kind of, like, we're, since living in North America, we don't have a ton of contact with Arrow since they're mostly European side of stuff, but just from all the stuff that I have seen and talking with people, they're kind of like, they've really curated like a really awesome, they take a lot of the old stuff. It's kind of like a bit of a Criterion Collection type vibe where they're remastering old stuff so that people can discover them again, as well as they're picking some really exciting, interesting titles. I saw that they did the UK version of The Endless, which was a festival favorite of mine last year, by Benson Moorhead. And it's just like, I was really honored to find that they are not only interested, but that we managed to sign with them. It's just, I feel like I'm in really good company with people that just really like cool movies. And so I feel like I took that as a good sign that we tried to make something interesting that hopefully other people will respond to.
And well, tell us a little bit about Harpoon, how the idea first came about. It seemed it's been a kind of recurring thing on the podcast because it's been talked about a few times. There was a little bit of Mike's episode where he mentioned a boat movie, as it was called then, and he mentioned it a little bit on your episode as well, although we mainly talked about your previous film, Alive.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, the working title of a boat movie is just because me and Mike are notoriously terrible at titles. That's usually the hardest part, I find, too. It's like, you know, you write something and you're trying to get all these themes, and then at the end it's like, okay, how do I sum this up in a little interesting, engaging title? And me and Mike both fully admit that we're terrible at that. But for the longest time, it made a lot of sense because there's a lot of literary references in the movie. The movie's very tongue-in-cheek, that it made sense that we were also kind of making fun of the title as well. But at the end of the day, another movie got released at Fantastic Fest just as we were finishing up the movie called The Boat. And so we were like, well, going to have to change that. And then the inside joke became, like, the title Harpoon came from what's a constant reoccurring joke in the movie. And it kind of actually, in hindsight, works better because the same way the joke in the movie without spoiling anything is referring to one thing, but it's actually another. I feel like the movie kind of does that a couple times to the audience members as well. So in the end, I think it all worked out to finally be the correct title. But where to start with that? So if Mike, when would Mike have been on? That's a year or two ago now? I'm not sure.
Yeah, it was earlier last year that I recorded that episode. I first met him at Dead by Dawn.
Yes.
April last year. And so I think we recorded our interview in May, even though it went out later.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So, I mean, we were, I mean, I edited, like, I'm sure we've covered this, but I edited his movie Knuckleball. Yeah. We did Fake Blood together. And then I went on to do a live that he was additional producer on. And I think, like I said, I feel from my last podcast where there was some growing pains in me making my first movie where I wasn't the main writer on. And there's just some frustration levels that I found I was dealing with and trying to get my head into the material as good as I could. But there's just, you know, if you're not the writer, there's always a level of disconnect that I just feel like maybe I couldn't fully engage. And I think Mike saw those frustrations. And it's also, and I'll be honest, it's like it's getting to a point in the industry where it's really tough to guess how things are going to go once the movie's made. It seems like every year everyone's having to relearn the market for how to sell a movie and make your money back and how to get it out there. And it's every year either the prices are going down or it's getting more and more difficult. And I think I was just complaining to Mike. I was just like, okay, I just want to go back to writing something that I really enjoy. And I've got this weird idea that I don't even know if it would be like commercially viable. And I pitched it to him as Polanski's A Knife in the Water by way of Seinfeld characters. And I kind of used that as the pitch. So it's like a survival story of three people, but they're all self-centered in their survival. And he said, it's an awesome premise. Like, just write it. And I feel like during the whole writing process of that, I kind of just went for broke because part of me was thinking, you know, this is my last kick at the can just because I can't tell which direction the market's going to go anymore. I might as well just try something that's really crazy and not worry about what the audience's expectations or how neatly it fits in a box, because I do think it's a bit of a challenging movie in the sense that it keeps changing its genre and tone. But I think Mike, thanks to him, he allowed me the freedom to try all these things and swing for the fences. And it was either going to fall completely flat in its face or we were going to pull it off. I don't think there was any way for it to be in between with this project. And luckily for him, he trusted us to just try and go crazy with it. And that's kind of how Harpoon came about, really.
When you were writing the script, it's funny that you mentioned Seinfeld characters there. Well, because obviously, yeah, the characters are quite self-centered. They are at times very unsympathetic, not very likable. Were you worried at all about pushing that too far, about making them too unsympathetic or just too nasty, too cynical?
For sure we were worried about it, but that's, again, it brings back to Mike being able to have the confidence to say, just go for it. Again, don't worry about whether the audiences are like, I think it was Mike that said to me multiple times before, he's like, you don't have to, he's like, you don't have to have sympathy for them, but you should have empathy. And I think that where that came from for us was just making sure, okay, these people can all do vile and disgusting things, but we need to understand why they did them. And I think Mike was fine with them being bad people as long as they weren't just doing bad stuff willy-nilly. I feel that we wrote a good enough script, though, that all of their bad stuff they do is justified, at least in their own internal logic of why they'd react to these situations. And I often say at Q&As where it's people are like, oh, how were you able to write these? And I was like, you know, part of what's enjoyable for writing for me is I get to explore the darker side of what I think sometimes. And I feel like at any given moment, all three of these characters have a bit of my bad personality traits or characteristics in them, just taken and turned up to 11. But I feel like I'm a bit of all three of these characters at certain moments. And a part of me for also, and this has come up a few times in Q&As and stuff where discussions will come up about what is it about these characters that they really find horrible and disgusting. And a part of me is finds that there's either a camp that can really get behind them doing these bad stuff, or there's a camp that's really appalled and disengages. And I find that one to be the more interesting one, because I feel like if you're fully disengaged from these people, you're not really admitting that we all have these traits with it, or you're just not willing to admit, you know, that we all feel jealousy, we all feel anger and resentment, you know. I've met plenty of people that have acted like these people, maybe not taken this far, but you know, some people want to face what these darker elements inside of us, and some people want to pretend that they don't exist, I think is a kind of where it ended up.
I don't know, that reminds me, just again, because you mentioned Seinfeld, that reminds me, I remember watching a kind of behind the scenes thing from Seinfeld in one of the box sets. And Jason Alexander says that, you know, like he goes up to Larry David with a script and says, like, oh, why, you know, how nobody in real life would react to this situation like this. And Larry David turns around to him and says, like, I was in that situation. That's exactly how I reacted.
Oh, yeah.
That's how he knew how to play George Costanza.
Yeah. He's basically is Larry David. Yeah. Yeah. No, here's the thing. And Mike and I had the conversations too. It's like, well, how come Seinfeld was able to pull it off? How come they were able to do these? Because they are like really bad people, but we still find them endearing. And Mike's like, well, you had 9 seasons to get to know them. We have 83 minutes. And he's like, you're already not going to succeed on a certain level with a vast majority of people that don't like to get behind bad people. And so again, it was his confidence to say, don't worry about those people. Just make sure that if they're going to be this way, that it's justified and that you can answer people's questions about it after. And so that kind of is what dictated our level of how much we should be cognizant of their reaction or how they're acting to one another. And I feel like that was since then, that kind of opened us up to allow them to do whatever we wanted with them. You know, it's another one of those things. If they're all nice to each other, I feel like it would have been a much more boring movie.
But they do seem to take turns, kind of.
Yes.
In that there's in each kind of beat of the film, there's bits where like one of the characters' positions seems vaguely rootable, and then you're like, oh, and then they do something, and then you're like, no, they're a dick. But then somebody else comes around and they do something like vaguely good, and you're like, ah, well, maybe they're the one, you know, like,
yeah,
becomes the kind of the hero of the film. Like, so there's still like a compelling thing there.
Yeah, well, that's, I don't know, maybe it's, and that's the thing is, I like to think, someone at our first screening in Rotterdam, I think, said, they're like, how pessimistic are you in real life? Because this movie kind of has a pessimistic feeling. I'm like, I'm actually really optimistic for the most part. I'm very optimistic about people and stuff. And I feel like, I hope that some of that comes through, that no matter how bad some of these people are, they still have qualities that, you know, I could get why I'd be friends with someone like this. And I kind of, that's how I look at it. I'm sure that there's obviously the other camp that, you know, there's, while they may have some positive qualities, they're only focused on those negatives. And so they write them off. It's interesting because it feels like, you know, the overall movie's just really about friendship, trust, and betrayal, which I feel are universal themes regardless of, you know, ethnicity, race, gender, all of that stuff, and good or bad. It's I feel that's kind of where my focus lies, and then all the outside stuff, it kind of, then it's like those are to dissect separately. But it's every Q&A has always led to these interesting questions about what you'd be willing to let your close friends get away with or not.
It does, yeah. I can see kind of where that question came from, because like the film has a little bit of a kind of, I would say, a gleeful nihilistic streak. Not like pure nihilism. It's not like like, I don't feel like by the end of the movie you feel like bummed out of being like, oh God, people are awful. I want to hang myself. Like, you know.
Gosh darn it. Someone said at one of the screenings, and they said it best to me. They're like, I normally don't like movies where you follow the villains. And he mentioned like very bad things and stuff like that. He's like, I normally don't like movies like that. It's like, what I really liked about this one, though, is that we knew they were bad people, but you were just waiting to see what the bad things they were then going to do to each other as like comeuppance. He's like, that's what made it different. It's like, you knew that they were going to get their just desserts. And he's like, that's what made it entertaining. I'm like, oh, okay, that's an interesting spin on how it's not something that I thought of, or, you know, was like intentionally trying to do, but it was interesting to hear his take on that. It's like, yeah, it's like, even if you don't like these people, you should then just be hoping and waiting for what's coming to them.
I don't want to spoil the reveals about any of the characters, because I definitely think it's a movie that it's good to watch with as little information as possible.
Exactly. I'm trying to be very careful about what I say.
Yeah. The interesting thing, though, and I don't think it spoils the movie, because there's none of the reveals or anything are in it. But anyway, the character of Jonah, yeah, the one that's played by Monroe Chambers.
Yep.
Do you think he would be viewed as more likable, like, if this movie had been made like 10 years ago? And the reason I asked this is because I was thinking, like, well, this is the kind of geeky, sad sack, kind of loser guy character that might have been played empathetically, but now, like, knowing what I do now and knowing, like, all these kind of angry alt-right keyboard warriors that I can imagine Jonah being, you know, like,
yeah,
I think he plays more unsympathetic now than if I saw this movie in my early 20s.
Absolutely. For sure, that was a conscious decision as well. I mean, maybe I'll set this movie up a little better, just for those that don't know about us, about any of it yet, is the opening. I can at least kind of give that pitch. Is, you know, we've got three very close friends who've probably been friends for far too long, and has passed their expiry, but they kind of cling to each other because that's all they really know. So they're all kind of bad for each other at this point. They all bring out each other's worst traits, but they've still, every now and then, they show a glimmer of what they used to be like, and that's kind of what has kept them, or keeps them, together, regardless of all the nonsense they get into. But Richard is the big, at first glance anyway, the big brute jock. Sasha's been his long-term girlfriend, who's kind of gotten used to Richard's wealth and just the level of lifestyle that he provides her. And then Jonah's always kind of been the sad sack third wheel. And that happens until the very opening of the movie, where Richard's convinced that Jonah and Sasha are having an affair behind his back, and then a big fight ensues, and it turns out that Jonah and Sasha convince Richard that they weren't having an affair, and so he feels very sorry and decides to take them out on a boat as an apology, and then things go haywire from there. But it's going back to Jonah specifically, and maybe it's because, I mean, for sure, you have to, when you're writing nowadays, you have to be aware of what the world's political climate is, or you should be aware, because you also don't want to ever come across as tone deaf, or that you're not participating or taking part in that conversation. Yeah. And I definitely, in my younger years, you know, there was a long period of time where I was not very good sociable and didn't communicate well with the opposite sex and stuff. And like I said, there's a lot of those traits I feel like I've had inside of me, and it can be as sympathetic as you want, but the conversation has changed, where it's like, you know, if the character feels they're owed something, that's where that sympathy starts to wane. And I can guarantee you that I've gone that. It's like, what do you mean? Why? I'm a nice guy. I deserve all these things. Why is it not being given to me? Or it seems like the movie really wouldn't exist if all three of these characters were able to self-evaluate themselves on a certain level. And I mean, that's maybe one big thing that I'm constantly wrestling with, is am I constantly self-evaluating? I mean, to be honest, this entire movie was just one giant therapy session for me. So that might be where a lot of the internal conflicts all stem from.
Yeah. I think so, and I think the reason I pick out that character particularly is because, like, I'm like an awkward horror fan, mental head, like in my teens, in my early 20s, you know, there was parts of my personality that were a bit like that, But yeah, they never curdled in the way that I've seen, like, with the invention of Twitter and Facebook. And I'm like, yeah, oh, fuck. It's like, you know, when you internalize that and suddenly think that the world owes you shit, oh god, that you know, what seems like innocent enough turns really fucking bad.
Yeah, it can, and it can go quick. And I think that's another reason why some people, and like, it's happened at the a couple of screenings where people have reacted very strongly negatively to these characters and stuff. And like, I honestly do believe that there's, if you're reacting that strongly, it's either you're seeing something in the characters that you absolutely won't admit that you have inside yourself, or something that you've already, like, there's something about that that would make you react that strongly against it. And I feel like it's, people just don't want to admit how quickly you can become the bad guy. I mean, the reality is all three of these people, if you were to ask them, if they were the hero of their own stories, I guarantee you all three of them believe that they're the heroes of their stories. And I feel like, again, that just goes back to their justifications. No villain thinks they're the bad guy. And I think that was a strong theme that we were working with throughout. And I don't know. Yeah, this movie just felt like, from the very beginning, just in a lot of the conversations that me and Mike have outside of movies and stuff, is just all those internal conflicts and how quickly they can build and fester and go south. And that was kind of the interesting part. I mean, the fact that these three people get stranded on the boat kind of feels secondary to a lot of just the ideas that we had discussed and wanted to explore. I actually say a lot, actually, at some of the Q&As too, which, you know, a part of me, I've been stuck. So the exact situation, as I was writing this movie, my friend has a boat in Vancouver where I live, and we got stuck out on the boat. And the exact way the boat shut down, I don't want to spoil it, but the exact way the boat shut down had happened on our trip. We were stuck out there. And I often think, you know, and this has happened to me, where I just do a thought exercise. Is, okay, what if a crazed gunman came into this McDonald's where I'm sitting down and having lunch? How would I react? Would I lunge towards him, or would I hide behind another person? And I kind of use the boat as my example of three different ways that I could react to being stuck. Would I act heroic, or would I try to be self-preserving? And it's I think everyone likes to think that they do the idealistic thing. I just don't. I'd like to think that I'm honest enough with myself that I just don't know how I'd react in those situations.
I think a lot of people feel the same. I mean, I'm not sure. I mean, like, I'd like to think that I would act how I envision as honorably, you know, protecting others, but maybe I just shit myself. I don't know.
Yeah, exactly. So it was all good cathartic thought experiments to on this project.
Yeah. Have you ever seen that movie, Force Majeure, the one where...
It has the best premise that I've ever heard when someone pitched to me. Just that opening premise of running away and leaving your family when the avalanche is coming. I mean, someone told me that. I was like, that is the cleverest premise of all time, especially when the avalanche doesn't make it to them. But I'll fully admit it, I haven't sat down and watched through the whole thing yet. But it's on my list.
Did it come up at a Q&A or did
no, this was like, I think I had a short, I might have had my short film at TIFF when that was premiering at TIFF or something like that. And just someone told me that premise, and I was like, that's the funniest thing ever. Because that's my perfect type of awkward humor. It's like, those are the types of things that I would just love to see how people react afterwards.
going back to, the movie, where how quick was it in terms of the turnaround from going from script to screen?
It was crazy, actually. So we finished shooting Alive in September. I think I'd written the first draft of what then was called the boat movie by October, while I was still editing Alive. So I'd edit like probably all day. And then at night, like all the stuff that I'd be thinking about while editing Alive, I would then just vomit out onto the page. And then I gave, Mike and me kicked ideas back, and we were honing the script, and we were in camera I finished editing Alive, like locked picture editing in Alive in December. And then we started shooting a Harpoon January. Like it was a crazy quick turnaround. And it's, we were originally supposed to, like, Mike was looking into whether we were going to be shooting in Fiji. And then the Fijian government turned the script down on moral grounds. Yeah, they didn't like that one. So then we looked into Hawaii.
You put that in because, the poster.
I know, hey. Turned down for moral grounds. Yeah. And then we looked into Hawaii because we're like, oh, Lost shot there. We should look into that. But then we found out that the loophole for Canadians to shoot there, we would have had to flown to Europe and come into the country through Europe for some weird reason to get the work visa. So that just didn't become feasible. And we were just running out of time and we didn't want to push the movie. So we started building the interiors of the boat in Calgary and started shooting the interior set of the boat mid-January before we even had our exterior location or our exterior boat. And then it just so happened that they found Belize and found a boat in Belize. And so it just kind of, it came together very fast and very last minute.
So you must have got the cast together quite quickly as well.
Yeah.
How did it, was it through, I take it was through Mike that Munro came onto the picture because obviously he's in Knuckleball and obviously you edited that. So was it just through that?
It was, so what happened was like we finished Alive and I, Thomas Cockrell, the lead from that I originally was talking to him about playing the Richard character and it turned out he was unavailable, but his management company 360 really enjoyed working with us on that. And so rather than go through a casting agent, we actually said, we're like, hey, well, here's our next one. It's coming together really quick. It's going to feel very similar. But I feel at that point, that company at least felt like we weren't a bunch of idiots. So they were like, oh, yeah, why don't we pitch you a bunch of our own clients? And that's where Emily Tyra and Christopher Gray came on. But we couldn't find the right Jonah. And it was also one of those ones where it's like, it's a really challenging role on paper. People are either going to be like, yes, I love that challenge. Or they're going to be like, this is a dangerous, like you said, it's a dangerous role to play in this climate. And so that was when, and I hadn't really even considered Munro. For some reason, just from editing him in Knuckleball, I had him as a different person in my head. That didn't feel like correct for that role. It's also the like linchpin role of the movie. And I just, for some reason, my brain wasn't considering him for that role until Mike's like, you need to watch him do a scene from this movie. So he got Munro to tape a scene without even telling me and then sent it to me. And then as soon as I saw it, I was like, oh yeah, that's Jonah. So that's how that one came about. And it was a, very quick turnaround from that. And then the cool thing was, so like I said, we shot in January, a tropical boat movie in January in the middle of winter in a landlocked province of Alberta, Calgary interior boats. So, but Mike, knowing, being the awesome producer he was, right off the bat said, he's like, you know, this is three people talking for 88 minutes. You need some rehearsal days. And so he was smart enough to actually schedule in 3 days with just me and the actors in the hotel before we went to camera, where every day all we did was meet right after breakfast and we'd went into the conference room of the hotel and we just ran through all the scenes, all the entire script each day over and over. And we would just rewrite and adjust as we went until they had that rapport. It also kicked out a lot of the, got rid of like interesting stuff. Like, I mean, the thing's written very much like a stage play. It's in two acts. Or two parts. And we found that on day one of the rehearsals, they'd be reading their lines, but they'd be feeling like they'd have to do something physically, like fidget or pace or change their blocking. And I was like, we realized, we're like, no, let's be confident with the words here and plant ourselves. People don't walk around this much when they talk. You're on a small contained boat and you got very little energy from lack of food and water. And so we made a conscious effort, and it was a risk. Again, it's like, are these words going to be interesting enough to just watch these people sit in one spot for a 10-minute scene and hope that we don't bore the crap out of them? But that was kind of stuff we discovered in the rehearsal process, is to get rid of all the extra fluff that just didn't need to be there and really boil it down.
Do you like working like that? I mean, like, I noticed, like, in terms of small scale, intense stories. I mean, I know you didn't write Alive, but that's a movie that's only got three actors. This movie's only got three actors. Is there going to be a three actor trilogy? Is it the next movie going to?
It's mainly budgetary constraints for the most part. At this level, you can't afford to go too big. But I mean, I grew up watching Richard Linklater, and I just love watching people talk. My genre brain then comes in and wants to add either a knife or a gun to that equation. But I think that's the kind of stuff I gravitate towards initially, is that I just like hearing people talk. I love, even in real life, I can just sit and listen to other people have conversations. Mm-hmm. And so that's, I think that's where my what I'm attracted to in the first place. But I mean, this is the first time I had the opportunity, I was given the opportunity to do the rehearsal process too. So yeah, it's the small crew stuff for sure. I find when you have a bigger crew, it just feels more like babysitting. And like, it's that classic line is, you know, the host of the party's never having any fun. So it just feels like you're constantly running around making sure shit's not falling apart. But we also went back to a single camera shoot on this one. And I found that helped a lot too, because I could really just focus in on the acting and the words and just the single shots. And it grinded the actors because they'd have to do way more takes. But it also, I think, helped lend to their level of exhaustion as we went along, because we got the opportunity to shoot all the interiors in order. And then when we went to Belize, we shot all the exteriors in order. I think that was a real benefit to the script and just to their story arcs.
Well, I mean, I take it being that close quarters, was how difficult was the shoot? Was it an easy shoot? Was it quite intense?
I'd love to have a good story about it, that it was difficult, but it was super easy. It was like, we brought along all of the same crew from Alive, so we had a great rapport already. That crew is really awesome, super professional. There's the usual problems that occurred, but we were so prepared on this one. The actors were so prepared. We lost a day just because of the set needed an extra day of work to be built. So we lost a day of shooting. And on a 15-day shoot, like, that's a lot of missed time. But they were so prepared that we made that day back up on the interiors and got a day ahead of schedule, which, like, on an indie film, that's just, like, crazy. That doesn't happen. So...
sailing.
Well, the funny thing is our amazing production designer Tim Rutherford, who built the set, which is like, it's the one of the more gorgeous, a lot of people don't even know that interior was a set, but as soon as he brought in some of the stuff that was like bad omens on an ocean, he's like stuff started going wrong on set, man. It's like so that's probably like the only time that stuff started going sideways. But that metal albatross statue apparently was causing him problems.
Yeah, yeah. I like the, again, I don't want to spoil it, but yeah, I like the joke about the bad omens.
Well, I mean, you can't do a movie on this ocean without getting into all the weird superstitions that occur, I felt. And I just find some of them are just so hilarious that I think it helped add to just the nonsense that needed, because the movie gets very serious in parts, and then, you know, it switches on a dime and turns to these lighter scenes. It just felt like it fit with the nonsense of the whole movie.
Of course, that ties in with one of my favorite things about the movie, and that is the sadistic, or the hilarious narration that happens throughout the movie. So how did the narration is done by Brett Gelman? How did he come on the project? And at what point was the narration put on?
That was a long process, because we always knew that we wanted the narration. And I know there's a really negative connotation with narration. It's like, oh, it's just lazy writing and stuff. But I was like, man, some of the best movies of all time have narration. It's like Shawshank Redemption, Goodfellas. It's like, what are those? Is that bad narration? Like, what are we talking about here? If it's helping the story, which our goal with ours is, and we have these three close friends who have known each other since childhood, we didn't want them to have to say to each other expositional backstory. We didn't want that phony bull stuff where they're like, hey, remember that time where we did this together? It's like, friends don't do that. They have a shorthand. They talk to each other as if everyone's, of course, knows the history. And that was always right from the start, is that the narration was supposed to set up their relationships and their backstories so that by the time they started interacting with one another, we didn't have to, you know, listen to them say unnatural dialogue to like that to one another. And so that was always the goal and the point of the narrator. I mean, it changed an awful lot from the script phase. At one time, it was even more self-referential about pitching this movie to executives. And it got a little more on the nose about some of the themes that we were trying to touch. And then just through the editing process, it kind of dialed back to the bare bones that it needed to be, or like the levity that it needed to hit at certain elements. For the entire editing process, it was either me recording it. I mean, we auditioned like 9 or 10 people just to try and see what the correct sound was. And then we were in talks with, John Cleese for a while to do it.
Really?
Yeah. We talked with him. We went back and forth with his team for a couple months, and it just didn't work out. And then right before we found out we were having we got the call on Christmas Day that we were going to premiere at Rotterdam, which was awesome for us to hear, because prior to that, you know, this is such a weird movie. It lives in this weird gray zone. And we had gotten a bunch of no's from a whole bunch of premiere festivals. And it's like, uh-oh, did we make a lemon here? Is this something that people aren't going to engage in? And then Rotterdam said yes, and that was kind of, it kind of at least changed the conversation where people are like, oh, maybe we should take a look at this weird ass subgenre talking horror survival movie. And so we basically, after Rotterdam gave us the go-ahead, we had a month to find our narrator. And that's when 360 management came in again to save our ass. And they said, what about Brett Gelman? We recorded his narration 2 days before the premiere. And I had to fly down to LA, record it with them, edit it on the plane back, cut it in, and export that night to carry with me by hand to Rotterdam, where we didn't even get to like test it before we got there. So it was a bit of a scramble.
Mm-hmm. I've never quite understood I get the theory about it being lazy writing, but I've never quite understood. I think because like a bunch of my favorite movies, some of which you mentioned, but also things like I recently rewatched The Princess Bride.
Yeah, exactly.
The Big Lebowski. A bunch of my favorite movies have narration. And I think, as long as it doesn't intrude on this story too much. And I think also it often depends on like the voice of the narrator. Some people you just are eminently listenable to, you know?
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
And I think it works here.
Yeah, well, thank you. Well, that's the thing is, yeah, I feel like it's got a bad rap for sure. But I feel like as long as it's doing what it's meant to do, and ours was just so that our characters could act like themselves and not have to say all this expositional stuff, that was our main point. And it just helps so much that Brett's a fantastic comedian, a fantastic actor, and he brought so much nuance just to the way that he would deliver certain words in the sentences and stuff. And it kind of brought the gleefully nihilistic tone, as you said, home for us, because it's just the perfect. He's got a very good level of that, especially if you've watched any of his Adult Swim skits that he's done.
Absolutely. Also, talking a little bit more about Brett's narration, was it your idea for the trailer, which is effectively like a parody of a trailer?
Yes, we had that written when we went into the studio with them. And we just recorded that last night. We're like, hey, we have this weird idea for a potential trailer. It might work, it might not. And then we discussed it with him. He really liked the idea. He's like, no, that's funny. So for Brett Gelman to tell me that's funny, I was like, okay, we're going to use this. And then that sat on the shelf like for months after we recorded it, because the goal was to just get in the main stuff first. And then, yeah, that's just a couple months later, it was like, people were like, okay, we should start thinking about a trailer. I'm like, actually, I've got this weird thing that we recorded. You mind if I try? And again, I still didn't know if it would work. And it just so happens that people seem to find it pretty funny.
I think it is funny. I think it's a good joke. And also, I like that it doesn't really give anything away about the movie. This trailers seem to get longer and longer. And mm-hmm. You know, like sometimes, particularly blockbusters, there's some summers that you're like, you watch the trailer and you're like, well, I feel like I've seen the movie. I'm not sure if I need to go to the cinema what's anymore. Left.
Yeah, what's left? No, it's the same with us. We feel the exact same way. It's also, I think it goes back to what you said earlier. It's like, this is a movie where it's kind of better to go in a little dry without knowing as much as you can or as little expectations. But I feel like the good thing about it is that the way he delivers the narration for the trailer, it still sets you up for the type of movie that you might be getting into, where it's got that tongue in cheek and it's got a bit of self-referential, and then there's going to be some violence. That's pretty well all you need to know.
Absolutely. And also, last thing on the trailer, because I've always been a firm Titanic hater, it is better than Titanic.
I appreciate that. That's where me and you might have to disagree. I'm like an avid Titanic defender.
Yeah?
Just avid. What's I saw it at the perfect age for it to leave an impression on me, but it's like, it's got everything. It's a love story. It's like an action movie. It's just got absolute. It's a kitchen sink movie, and it's one of my guilty pleasures for sure. I even went and saw the re-release in 3D. It's still held up.
Oh, wow. Okay.
But I've been trying to chase True Lies again, because I can't find that one anywhere online, or it's not on VOD or anything, so I might have to get another copy of that. That's also a kitchen sink movie, it feels like.
Yeah, I suppose that's a kind of daft over the top movie. I don't think it's one of Arnie's best or one of Cameron's best. I think
It was the highest grossing of all time at one point. I mean, that's just his MO.
Yeah, that's just like he just makes them. Yeah. It'd be interesting to see if he does that again with Avatar 2.
Or 3, 4, 5.
Or 3, 4, 5. Yeah. They're just doing them in between Star Wars. It's mental. It's mental.
Yeah.
That's a whole other conversation about Disney buying the film industry.
Absolutely. Which is like, it's great because we're getting all these crazy big movies, but yeah, it's the thing is, it goes back to where I was just like, I don't know where there's not a lot of room for indies anymore. You know, the average person probably only sees 2 or 3 movies a year. And if they're sucking those up with, like going to the theater 2 or 3 times a year. And if those are getting sucked up with the latest Star Wars or the latest Avengers movie, it doesn't leave a lot of room for 3 people talking on a boat doing bad stuff to each other. That's for sure. So,
there's still an audience for that. I mean, like, I'm a little bit in the bubble because I am the type of person who goes to film festivals and the type of person who goes to like the kind of art house cinema in my town. And I know that a lot of people's towns don't have art house cinemas. I live in Edinburgh. Yeah. We have 2, which is unusual.
Yeah, exactly. We're on the fringe, I think. That's for sure. Yeah. And it seems like less and less some of those ones kind of transcend or cross over into the mainstream. So it's just, you know, I feel the movie summed up my the existential crisis I was having about independent cinema quite well.
Do you not think the fact that certain ones are hitting that people might investigate? Like the fact that things like Us and recently released, released this week, Midsommar, have kind of hit like a nerve. And do you think people kind of investigate horror more?
The horror, I have no problems. I think that they will for sure. The independent stuff is what scares me a little because
what I mean. Like in terms of like it seeping down to like checking out more, because I mean, they're like not mainstream pictures, but they're not indie pictures, those kind of pictures.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, they're in that like classic $30 million, the Pulp Fiction range.
Yeah.
Boy, that would be nice to have that kind of budget.
Yeah,
obviously. We're still in the sub-million budget range. But I can't knock it too much. It's just, you know, there seems to be a number that you have to hit, and it's just a tough business. And I think I'm never going to be one to shy away, especially if people are listening, to try and get insights on how they can do this themselves. I'm always the first to admit that this is, it's not easy. It's a lot of work to get something made, to put a year or two of your hard work into then the editing of it. And then for the hope and prayer that a festival needs to like, a top tier festival, a big enough festival needs to say yes that it attracts a sales team or sales agent. It's a long haul. It's a, it can wear you down sometimes. And yeah. I think that's a, that it put a lot of what my frustration into it was into Harpoon perhaps. So I was like, you know what, look, if I don't get another opportunity to do this, I might as well try and say all the stuff that I've had, I've been building up towards.
So. Yeah. I mean, absolutely. I mean, hopefully best case scenario, we can work together, you know, and I can get you up to the kind of Ari Aster budgets, and you can get me up to like Marc Maron numbers, you know, like.
There we go. That's the goal. It's always the goal. What are Marc Maron numbers? Are they crazy? What are Marc Maron numbers? Are they like crazy?
Oh yeah. I think like WTF, the WTF podcast that gets like, I like some like 500,000 downloads a month. It's like,
wow.
Yeah. I mean, like he's right up there, like him and like, I think
Joe Rogan,
even more like, you know, like
those
kind of, those are some huge fucking numbers for podcasts.
Yeah. It seems like, when he puts like, when Joe Rogan puts even on the YouTube, which is not the main place that people watch it, the YouTubes gets like millions of hits right off the top. And I'm just like, Jesus, that's a lot of, and it's just him sitting having conversations. I was like, this is crazy.
At least, I mean, I have to say, I do listen to WTF. With Marc Maron, and he tends to keep his episodes to like an hour and a half kind of thing, you know, like and he generally interviews interesting people. Joe Rogan does as well, but I think like the reason the YouTube thing gets so many hits, I think, is because I don't know how many people are listening to whole Joe Rogan episodes.
He
has like a lot of conspiracy theories on, and it's like him and his mates getting stoned for like 3 hours. Like, it's like mental. I mean, people just want those 15-minute bites of just like, okay, I get the gist.
No, they definitely go crazy along. They're good to have in the background when you're like cleaning the house or something. Those ones come in handy.
For sure,
but that's the thing, is it's like, you know, it's like all this stuff is just such, seems like the industry, entertainment industry, and it's changed so much. It's just like everyone's just trying to keep up with where it's going, and no one seems to have a good predictor. Mike and me usually have a funny conversation anytime we're with like pitching to like studios or sales teams and stuff. They're always like, well, this is what's hot right now, do you have any of these movies? We're like, well, by the time this gets made and we finished, isn't that going to be not what's the hot commodity anymore? So we've always tried to bug and remind each other that the best thing we can do is just try to make something interesting and that we find personally interesting and exciting. And hopefully that we just get lucky that that's what people are hungry for by the time it gets finished and ready for release.
And to go back, to the movie, talking about what people are hungry for, it does seem like it, despite you having setbacks and a bunch of noise since Rotterdam, I've seen that you've been at other festivals, I've seen from horror sites that Harpoon's been getting pretty decent reviews, it seems to be getting pretty decent reactions, it seems to really have picked up steam.
No, we got really lucky. Like at first, you know, before Rotterdam, we were nervous for sure. It's like I said, you got to wait for at least that one, like top tier or like mid tier festival to kind of give you the seal of approval, and then other people start catching on. But we got lucky as that happened. Yellow Veil came on as our sales team, and they're kind of, we got lucky that they were interested because they're kind of becoming, they're brand new, but they're kind of becoming like really good tastemakers for a lot of the indie genre stuff coming out. And the festivals we've gotten in has been like real lucky and a privilege and an honor. And even like Chattanooga is like still a new upcoming one, but they have such a great genre following, and the people that show up there, it's almost like it was more about getting to know the other filmmakers than it was about the screenings itself. And it's definitely the one where I feel like people that get the movie really have gotten it and are into what we were trying to do. There's always going to be the crowd of, you know, knee-jerk reaction. No, but it seems like mostly positive reviews. The funny thing is, it's like, this is the first time that I've done a movie where I actively got rid of all of my, like, I didn't have Facebook before, but I still had like a struggling Twitter account. And I finally, right as this movie was getting ready for Rotterdam, I just got rid of all of that as well. And I was just like, I need to stop paying attention to the results and enjoying the process a bit more. And I feel like it's certainly saved a bunch of my my mental sanity and not having to hear as much as the noise anymore. And I can just concentrate on my enjoyment of the process rather than having to hear people on Twitter tell me just how much they hate my movies or like them.
Yeah. I always find, again, like sometimes I just don't understand people. Like I always, there's movies I hate, there's movies I love, but I've never thought like I'm going to like tag the filmmaker. I'm going to put in my tweet at whoever it is who's made the film that I hated and say like, yeah, I hate your fucking movie. Fuck you for this movie. Like I might say like, you know, I hate this movie. I think this director is awful, but I won't actually put, you know, tag the director in. It just seems, I don't know. Yeah. It seems like a dick move.
It's the Wild West out there on the internet. But it's definitely helped me just be more aware of, or less aware of what's going on up there. I can at least, I enjoy talking to people about the movie, but there's that certain level of the anonymity on the, I just don't think, I might have just been too old for it. Like I didn't have internet in high school. I didn't have an email account till after high school. So I feel like I'm just on that subset just before where I feel like I can't really engage with a certain number of strangers online. So I don't think I was built for social media to start with, whereas I love talking to people that come watch the movie at the festivals and stuff, because at least there's a bit of a dialogue that can be had, whether they like it or not is, you know, less of a concern there. They at least came to give it a try, and that's all you can really ask for people to do.
Yeah, I kind of feel similar to you. I feel like I'm like on the cusp. I'm just about to turn 34. So, like, again, I remember not having, like, an email account or whatever, like, in my...
I'm 30. I'll be 35 in September, so it's the same. Yeah, we're just on that bubble.
I'll be 34 in September.
There we go. Yeah, we're just on that bubble.
Yeah.
Where we didn't communicate via a black box.
Absolutely not.
Yeah. And, I mean, like, don't get me wrong. It seems to help a lot of people. I also feel like it's just too much of a time suck for me. You know, I could be doing, I'd rather be playing video games on my own time or reading a book or working on the next script or whatever. But I find like that thing, especially on Twitter, it's really easy to just get sucked into the rabbit hole and keep scrolling, and finally just had to be like, this is not helping my productivity. So, but it's interesting because that opened up a whole other conversation too, where it's like the festival is like, okay, well, what's your Twitter handle? I'm like, oh, I don't have one. What's your Facebook handle? I don't have one. Well, how are you going to promote the movie? It's like, I'm hoping you guys are going to help do that. And it's put me in this strange bubble where they're like, ooh, filmmaker without followers, you know? And it kind of went back to the conversation, you know, even casting movies, they're like, oh, have you considered casting this person? They've got a million Instagram followers. I'm like, can they act? You know, it's a strange time. It leads to some weird questions about what people are using to sell their products or sell the movies. And I'm hoping that it's the actual quality of the film itself and not the amount of people I had following me. It's so, you know, it's put me in another gray zone where I'm not quite sure where it lands, but I think it's starting to turn a little bit where people are realizing that, you know, mental health is a little bit important in this equation as well. And if my mental health is better without that stuff, I think people are a little more open to the idea of like, oh, okay, he's going to be one of the guys that doesn't do that.
I think so. I think people are becoming more kind of like, because you hear more about people like taking time away from social media or like just switching off social media. There does seem to be more of that now that we've kind of, you know, because it was still all very new relatively, you know, like
for sure
was only came about in 2005, same with YouTube. Twitter is only 11 years old, you know, so I think people are starting to kind of get a little bit to grips with it and be like, you know, maybe it's not healthy to be on all the time.
Yeah. Yeah. But then there's like the other side, because like, I'm sure you need the followers to come and direct them to your site and stuff. And it's a strange one. So it's tough to say like, hey, I don't want to do this without it feeling like you're turning your back on that community. And so there's a, it's, I think, like, yeah, like you said, I think we're all just learning how to navigate this a little better.
Is Fright Fest like the next festival for you, or is a?
Nope, Fantasia in Montreal comes first. I'm going there July 27th, and then Monroe. That's the first time Monroe's going to get to see it in front of a crowd, just because he's been so busy. So that'll be fun to see how he engages with the audience, because that's the perfect. He'll get the most questions, I'm sure, after that one. And then we go to Fright Fest. And then it's not announced yet, but we have another one coming up after that. That's got a fairly large profile. And then that's hopefully that there'll be a little bit of a release announced that I can't say too much about yet. But there's some releases coming up after that. So I'm hoping that this thing will be available to most people sometime, either in early November, is my guess.
Yeah. And to go back a little bit. You mentioned that, you know, sometimes you said social media, you'd rather play video games or read a book. I was going to ask about the literary references in the movie. Mm-hmm. Were they like always there, like the kind of diversions into the I don't know, is it a spoiler to talk about the Poe stuff?
No, you can probably, we can mention Edgar Allan Poe. A lot of the sites have pitched it as a modern retelling of an Edgar Allan Poe story, which is like, I guess in a way, but it's more to be as like a comedic, like, we can talk about it. There's a really interesting, and I read this way, way back, and it's always stuck with me, is that one of the greatest coincidences of all time was that, Edgar Allan Poe had written a short story about three people stuck on a boat and drawing straws, and the loser's named Richard Parker. And then I think it was 20 or 30 years later, a real shipwreck occurred off, I think it was in Britain. I think it's where the boat left from, somewhere in the UK. And then they got shipwrecked and three people survived, and one of them drew straws to see who was going to eat the other. And the loser of that in real life was named Richard Parker, and his tombstone is in South Haven, I believe. Is that it? South Haven, I think, is the city.
Okay.
Maybe it sounds good. But we actually, and that's at the end of Harpoon, you see the real tombstone there. That's from the actual Richard Parker. And that, for some reason, that coincidence always stuck with me. And that was the original idea. I was like, wouldn't it be hilarious if they knew, these people knew about this, and then this happened to them as well? I think that was the original genesis of the idea. And I don't know if I've discussed how my writing process before is, but I'll usually come up with a concept, like just very broad strokes, and then it'll sit in the notes app in my iPhone for like up to 2 to 3 years before the rest of the pieces fall together. And then it comes out very quickly. But what I can't do is come up with a really, like an idea, and then get excited and just start writing right away, because it hasn't had enough time to like gestate in my brain, and I always get stuck at a certain point. And I can't remember what part of it clicked with me, but that concept was always meant to be in there. And I think finally I knew what the three characters were going to be years later. And then it all came out really quick.
I really like the scenes describing that story. I like the flashbacks. Mike has a cameo in that.
So do I, and so does Kurt.
Yeah, no, I know.
All three. Well, and that was because, like, we were in Belize, and we always knew we were going to do this. We wrapped production, and the very next day was always meant to be, like, we're just going to shoot these flashback scenes. And they were always meant to have that, like, Paul Thomas Anderson weird flashback feel. And we stole that pretty much from the beginning of Magnolia. Mm. And so we were shooting those, and Kurt was like, how is this going to look? This is so stupid. And I was like, don't worry. It'll fit the tone. Because the sea turtle in there was just like a couple pieces of like memory foam painted and taped together. It was very bizarre to shoot that the next day, half drunk on cervezas on the beach in Belize.
It's a hard knock life.
I would, yeah, that by far was the most pleasurable shooting experience, minus the weather, It's like everything went super well in the interiors because you're in complete control of the weather, the lighting. But then you get to Belize and they're like, oh, it had rained with like thunderstorms for like the first 3 days. And we're like, how often does it rain here? They're like, never. We're like, oh, now the film gods are paying us back for having a beachfront resort completely rented out by us. It was like a snorkeling resort. So we had just taken over it. We had our own private dock right at the front there. And that's just where the boat was posted up. So we just wake up in the morning, have our breakfast, and you just walk out on the dock onto the boat. And that was kind of our start of each day. So I feel like we had to get punished a little bit by the weather.
It's all that bad omen stuff, right?
Exactly. Well, the Tim refused to bring some of the, like, he's like, nope, I'm not flying with that, the albatross. He's like, nope, I just won't bring it. The hardest thing he had to bring in, actually, was the seagull. The Belizean government wanted to quarantine that because they were worried it was carrying diseases because we used a real seagull carcass, but they eventually let us in. Actually, you know what they don't like, didn't like and don't allow is drones either. So we had to get a special permit from the government. Because they don't want a bunch of tourists just flying drones all over the beaches. So we had to get a special permit to bring a drone in there. So that was kind of an interesting process.
You've had some interesting experiences with governments, the Belize government, the Fijian government.
Yeah, they don't like us pretty much, but Belize was a lot more accommodating. It's funny because when Mike found out, they're like, yeah, when Fiji was turning the script down on moral grounds, he was like, okay, well, what if a Marvel script came? They've got a lot of violence. He's like, well, they're bringing a lot more money. He's like, oh, you jerks.
that's not fair at all.
I mean, exactly.
You know, like moral grounds, it
should be black and white.
It's like, oh, we're moral on a Tuesday, but we're not moral on a Friday.
Yeah. They're moral until you bring $100 million into the economy, I guess. Yeah. But it worked out. Belize was like the perfect spot for us. I think it actually worked out better because we didn't know at the time, but Belize has the largest alive reef break now since Australia's is mostly dead. And so it kept the waters calm with that gigantic reef break. So it was, it helped with shooting on a boat. And it also helped when one of our lead actors who played Richard, Christopher Gray, had lied to me in the audition process that he had good sea legs. Apparently he was like, gets massively seasick. So he had to take a bunch of seasick pills before getting on the boat. But luckily he kept it together.
Well, that's good. And it all worked out in the end.
He didn't tell me until after. He's like, by the way, I get massively seasick. I'm like, you liar.
So, I mean, obviously Harpoon is still on its festival tour, and will be for a few more months. Do you have anything else in the pipeline? And also, I was wondering, do you want to focus on directing full time, or are you still going to be between Eddington projects and directing projects?
I've pulled. It's funny you mentioned that. I've pulled back on editing for my day job recently. You know, I was doing a lot of, aside from Mike's stuff, if Mike calls me to edit, I'll always say yes. But like my day job, you know, I was editing a ton of Hallmarks and Lifetime movies and stuff. And I was having a tough time enjoying that process as much just because it takes up a lot of your creative energy. It doesn't leave much for your own stuff. And so I decided I was going to pull back on that. And also due to some family stuff, my dad got diagnosed with cancer and I just had to start, I wanted to be able to focus on taking care of him. He's just gotten through his last treatment. He's doing well, so that's good. But it's allowed me to shift my priorities a little much. Right now, I'm a post supervisor. I get to go into work and let someone else have to do all their creative energy, use all their creative energy to see stuff through the finish line. And it lets me come home at a reasonable hour and still be able to save a bit of my energies for my stuff. And I can now be a bit more choosy about the editing projects I want to take on. In regards to my directing stuff, you know, it's like I said, I'll always be honest about this business. I go through, you know, a crisis once a month about how much of my energy do I want to put in this stuff? Do I want to keep doing it because it's just the love of the process, or do I see it constantly growing in the correct direction, because you know, it'd be tough to wallow in the same no budget space forever, just not, let alone on a creative aspect, but also from a financial aspect. Because for most of these ones, you kind of got to just, you'd got to almost take a pay cut or just enough that's going to pay the rent to get through these things sometimes by the time you've put a year and a half work into it. So I speak with Mike often. He wants us to do a bunch more together. I have one that I'm writing that's, again, I think it's a good sign that I'm in the headspace where I'm like, okay, if this is the last one I do, at least I'm going for broke. And it's a bit more of a, whereas I think Mike, what excited Mike was about Harpoon, whereas he's like, oh, this could be an art house genre movie. He's like, I could see the art house cinemas picking it up just as much as the genre festivals. And he kind of was right in that regard. It's like, you know, Rotterdam's not known for their genre stuff, but they are known for their great dramas and stuff like the and European cinema. Whereas then we've also played some more standard genre places. But this next one's that I'm writing right now is more of like a straight crime drama, but turned up to maybe 11 in the sense that it's going to have bits of hyper violence in the same way as Jeremy Saulnier movie does, where when it goes dark, it goes really dark. And so I'm writing kind of, I mean, a lot of people won't admit this, but Vancouver is technically a border town. It's right next to the American border. It's got a very large and drug trade that, you know, if you live in Vancouver, you've grown up there. It's like you've always been like you're one or two steps removed from just there's a darkness that's kind of not really talked about. And so I'm kind of writing a story that's very much based on that. Some that's two steps removed from these things, but is always around it and then suddenly just gets sucked into it. And that's kind of what I've been, the themes that I've been working on right now. Mm-hmm. And it's taking the opposite, whereas Harpoon's all about friendship and betrayal. This one's about just how much you'd be willing to, the loyalty side of that. So it always seems to deal with friendship, but that's kind of the other direction I'm taking this one, where I get to at least explore the other end of that coin.
that seems very interesting. I think, like, I mean, certainly from an outside perspective, because, I mean, in my mind, and I think in a lot of people's mind, you know, living out here, looking at Vancouver, that seems like a very friendly, lovely city. You know, you don't think of it.
Absolutely.
You know, you don't think of it having, like, that kind of dark side that you would maybe associate with Chicago or a Boston or a Mexico City or, you know, like something like
that. Yeah, exactly. So it's, yeah, it's trying to take the suburban level of crime and then turn it way up. So that's kind of where it's going. And it's the good thing is, and same with Mike, is, you know, there's a lot of, Canada is a pervasive biker gang thing. They do a lot of good for the communities, but there's also stories that you hear that you're always two steps removed from a lot of these really interesting stories, and we're kind of taking all the knowledge that we have in that and putting them into this weird script.
Okay. Absolutely.
And then we're also, the only other thing that we keep knocking back and forth is the idea is like, okay, if we don't really understand how the market's going to react by the time we get to the next movie, we've also thought about the experiment. It's like, what's the absolute bare cheapest we could make a project? And that's, we have a different script in mind. It's like, do you think we could go back to pulling off like a $10,000 movie again and seeing if that can do well on the marketplace? But these are all up until something happens. I think we're both in the mindset that we need to take a bit of a break first. So right now I'm trying to just enjoy not having another movie to work on.
Yeah. I mean, it does sound like you say, Jeremy Solney, and, you know, there does seem to be a market for that kind of hard, nasty crime. You know, like S. Craig Zahler is a good example of that as well. You know,
like, absolutely.
Very successful.
And then, yeah. What did you think of Dragged Across Concrete?
I've not seen it yet.
Let me know when you see it. I'll be very curious.
Yeah, it's a movie that I've heard very split reactions. Even more so than Bone Tomahawk or was it Brawl in Cell 99?
Brawl in Cell Block 99. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. This one's a bit more divisive, I think. I think it's the exact one that he wanted to make, but I think in doing so, I think he might have split the audience a bit more. But that's the price you pay. Like Mike Kovac, who I use as my barometer for a lot of my own thoughts and stuff, he's the one that says, he's like, well, did you do what you wanted to do in this movie? I said, yeah. He's like, well, then you got to be okay with not some people not liking that. I was like, all right, fine. So
that's very true. That's very true. I mean, like, yeah, sometimes you think you watch a movie and you're like, this is exactly the movie that the director wanted to make. And, yeah. You know, some people connect with that and some people do. I mean, I remember I weirdly watching the Nicholas Winding Refn film, Only God Forgives, which a lot of people hate. And like, I watched it and actually really liked it. And I could tell that this was, he like, Drive gave him a freedom to do exactly what he wanted to do. And this is,
yeah,
that's my sense of that movie.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, and that's the thing is, that filmmaker has to be okay with it. If you're going to be very specific about what you want to tell, not everyone's going to have the same sentiment that you do or see what you wanted to see. So I try to remind myself that often because I feel like the other option is, you know, you're very cognizant of what other people want to see. And then there becomes a disconnect. It's like, and then it's watered down or it's not what you wanted to tell. And then it just becomes like, who's this for? You know, so. So fine balance, all that stuff. And that's probably why a lot of the blockbuster people are very successful. I feel like what Spielberg wants to tell probably is very much in line with what a large audience wants to see. And that's probably what made him such a successful blockbuster director for so long. He had that quality where it lines up. Whereas I sometimes watch the blockbusters and then I'm like, okay, now I want to see something that's like completely different or opposite of this.
Yeah, I have that same experience as well, you know, like, because I mean, I can watch blockbusters. I watch the Marvel Studio movies and, you know, stuff like that and dig them. But, you know, sometimes I want something very different, sometimes much artier, sometimes much darker, you know,
yeah, whatever. You need the palate cleanser.
Yeah. For sure.
Yeah.
For sure.
It's like, it's weird. I think it's just how some people are like, when I watch a Marvel movie, like the first thing that comes into my head every time I see one is like, I want to see a superhero movie where they don't use their superpower. Like I want the entire movie to be their day-to-day lives and how they handle that. And I'm just like, I can guarantee 99% of people would not want to see that movie.
Yeah, absolutely. But then, you know, I think possibly we have a different sensibility to what a lot of people have. Like often I find the things that most enjoyable about Marvel movies is not always the big set pieces. Like I think like my favorite thing about Avengers movies quite often is the Avengers like bickering in headquarters rather than
exactly
the moon is exploding and you know like oh yeah. You know, necessarily, so, you know.
Let's give the 12 angry men, but with the Avengers around the table, pretty much.
Yeah.
Yeah. That would be a good one. Someone's got to write that. But that's what I mean. It's like put them in a place where their superpowers become obsolete and let's just see how they have to react to the challenges without that. That's kind of where I always go because the only thing that seems to irritate me about those movies is I'm always, and I haven't seen the latest one, and I know a bunch of people die. But prior to that, I was always like, I don't feel in danger for the leads. So I have a tough time engaging with that. Like if they can't die, who am I nervous for? Is always kind of how I felt about it. And so it was like, give me one where they lose their superpowers or something like that, I guess.
That was my guest Rob there, who I'd like to thank once again for returning on the show. Much like I hope you keep returning to the show, listeners. Also, if you are a fan, the best way you can support New Horror Express is to rate, review, and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and Radio Public. That's all for this episode, but be sure to join us again in 2 weeks' time where we will have another great guest from the world of indie horror for you. Until then, though, see ya!